What's good? You're listening to Code Switch. I'm Gene Demby. When President Trump took office in January again, one of his administration's first orders of business was to make good on a campaign promise to deport thousands of immigrants from the United States. The government has moved swiftly in that direction and often really messily. The United States is now in uncharted territory when it comes to immigration policy. There are now a bunch of lawsuits against the Trump administration for carrying out deportations that happen regardless of the subject's status in this country. Several judges have ruled that the White House had violated the due process rights of the people it rounded up, or they've told the government that it could not deport people to countries they're not from and have no ties to. And after the Trump administration got rid of legal protections for people from certain countries like Venezuela, a different judge ruled that the White House had to cut it out and said that, quote, acting on the basis of a negative group stereotype and generalizing such stereotypes to the entire group is the classic example of racism, end quote. But the Trump administration is very decidedly not cutting it out. And some legal scholars have said that we are witnessing a full-blown constitutional crisis, with the courts telling the White House that it could not do something because it's unlawful, and the White House just going ahead and doing it anyway. Sergio Martinez-Beltran covers immigration for NPR, and he's been trying to make sense of these stories, and he's been talking to a lot of families who have been swept up in it. Sergio, first of all, welcome to Code Switch.
Hey, Gene, it's so good to be with you.
Okay, so we know broadly that you cover immigration, but obviously that's a giant portfolio right now. So what exactly have you been looking into more narrowly?
Before I answer that question, I think I look at this job. You know that movie, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once? That's how it feels. You know, it's a lot. It's intense. And there's so many things happening during the Trump administration. But I've been focusing quite a bit on Venezuelan migrants because, I mean, in part, President Trump has made such a big deal out of it. Mm-hmm. He's been talking a lot about Venezuelans, accusing Venezuelans of committing crimes. And so that's the area that I've been looking into.
Why Venezuela? Like, why is Venezuela a particular, like, bugbear of his?
I've been talking to people about that, and I think the common answer is that the president has been trying to find or identify an external enemy in order to be able to, you know, carry out his mass deportation promise. And so Venezuela might be a good example. And particularly, he's been using this idea that Venezuelan immigrants, particularly Venezuelan men, are part of Tren de Aragua, which is an international criminal organization that was born at a prison in Venezuela. And he's been using that as an example of, you know, these Venezuelan men are part of Tren de Aragua, and that way they should be deported or sent to a prison overseas.
I would remind everybody in this room that Tren de Aragua is a foreign terrorist organization operating within the United States of America because the previous administration allowed them to invade our country.
That's Caroline Levitt, the White House press secretary.
Hmm. What do we know about the people who have been, like, on the business ends of this new American posture towards Venezuelan or to undocumented immigrants more broadly?
So the president of the United States and the Trump administration have decided to send immigrants to a maximum security prison in El Salvador. And that is something, Gene, that we haven't seen before, in part because there are many questions about what this means for the immigrants. Also, whether they have rights once they are in a different country. There are questions about due process with the Alien Enemies Act, which is this rare wartime law that the Trump administration has been citing to carry out its policy.
And to expedite removals of Tren de Aragua and other savage gangs like MS-13, which is equally vicious, I will invoke the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. Think of that.
Now, these men have not had a day in court, like in regular deportation procedures. The Venezuelans in El Salvador do not have access to lawyers or family members. And even before men were sent to El Salvador, earlier this year, over 100 of them were sent to the Guantanamo Naval Base, which was also something new. The U.S. had not transferred detainees from the U.S. soil to Guantanamo before. And then there's the debate on whether we should be calling these flights deportation flights or whether we should be calling it something else because the Trump administration is using a different rule here.
What else would we call it if we weren't calling them deportation flights?
That is the question. And right, and as a reporter, I have to be honest with you, it's something that I've been thinking about quite a bit because we want to be as accurate as possible. But this is not a deportation flight. And what I've been calling them is, you know, I've been saying that the Trump administration has been sending migrants to this maximum security prison in El Salvador. But I think calling them deportation flights might be inaccurate because there hasn't been a proceeding for them to be deported.
Okay, we're going to get into that. On today's show, we're looking at how the Trump administration is testing the legal system to carry out its stated goal of mass deportations. And we're going to start with the story of one family that, Sarah Hill, that you've been covering, that's been trying to find their 18-year-old son after immigration agents showed up at their doorstep one day.
I've been reporting on Carlos Daniel Terán, who is an 18-year-old from Venezuela. And, you know, I've been talking to his family almost every week, multiple times a week. And I've been talking to them because his case, I think it's pretty symbolic of what's happening here. Last year, Carlos Daniel embarked in the journey that many immigrants embark. He left his country and he went through the Darién Gap, which is this dangerous jungle between Colombia and Panama.
Very, very dangerous, yeah.
Yes, and then he continued making this trek all the way north to Mexico. The Trump administration has talked about how they want people to use legal pathways to come into the country. Well, it turns out Carlos Daniel Terán and hundreds of thousands of other Venezuelan men, but also other migrants, have used this app called the CBP One to present themselves at a port of entry and then ask for asylum and be allowed into the country.
Okay.
So Carlos Daniel did that, and he, you know, came into the U.S., and he was shielded from deportation while he waited for his immigration hearing. And that was last year when he was allowed in November of 2024. And it's important to know, too, that his family also came in through the same mechanism, through the CBP One app.
Okay.
And in January, a few days after President Trump took office on January 20th, federal agents, immigration agents with insignias that said ICE and DEA, they showed up to Carlos Daniel's home in Cedar Park, Texas.
Ellos entraron por acá y abrieron esa puerta y allá estaba un carro con dos personas.
It was Marian Terán, the stepmother of Carlos Daniel, the one who opened the door. And she opens the door. She sees all these men wearing, you know, these bulletproof vests and asking for her son. And so she was very confused, but she asked Carlos Daniel to come outside to meet this man.
El policía habló, el de inmigración lo agarró y el de la DEA lo esposó.
They put him in handcuffs. They allowed him to say bye real quick, and they ended up arresting him there.
El de inmigración se sorprendió mucho cuando lo vio. Hizo, uff, no se imaginan que era un chico tan joven.
Marian says that the agent that arrested Carlos Daniel was surprised to see that he was so young. I mean, I haven't seen him in person, but I've seen photos of him, and he's 18. He's very skinny and has a baby face.
Why was Carlos picked up?
So he's accused of being Tren de Aragua. He does not have a criminal record in the U.S., but in Chile, he was charged with gun possession and possessing or transporting small quantities of drugs when he was a minor. But his dad said he ended up leaving Chile voluntarily. Now, in the U.S., Carlos was living a different life than what he lived in Venezuela, right? Here, he realized that if he worked, he could earn some money and he could save. And that's exactly what he did. He started working at a nearby pizza shop as a dishwasher. He was practicing his English, and he saved enough money, Gene, to buy a used bicycle. About $13, and he bought it with his own money. There's a video of Carlos Daniel's dad, Juan Terán, recording his son. And he's riding this, like, beautiful blue bicycle in a gas station. And he's just starting to do all these tricks that I cannot do. He's doing wheelies and he's doing all this stuff. He's having a lot of fun. And
he's been an 18-year-old on a bike.
Right, a bike that he bought. And, you know, when you're like an 18-year-old, you know, when you buy that first big thing, you feel like the man. You feel like very big. And that's exactly what happened here. But that happiness only lasted a few hours because he got picked up by ICE the next day.
Oh, man. After that arrest, do we know what happened to him?
Yeah, so they took Carlos Daniel away. And what happened to Carlos Daniel is what happens to many immigrants who get picked up by ICE or other, you know, federal immigration authorities, which is that the family doesn't know where they're going to take him to. So for hours, the Terán family didn't hear from their loved ones. But then he ends up giving them a call and telling them he's at a detention center in Taylor, Texas.
Carlos Daniel, la primera vez que llamó, cuando le dieron la llamada por videollamada, la verdad es que él estaba bastante asustado.
Estoy muy angustiante. Sí, estoy muy, muy, muy dolido, muy triste, porque pues para ningún padre es fácil ver que un hijo esté detenido injustamente.
Even though it was really hard for the family to certainly see their 18-year-old in this detention center, they were able to communicate with him. And so they were able to track how he was feeling. Carlos Daniel, if you see photos, Gene, he is very, very tall and very, very skinny. You know, like a typical, I think, a teenager, you know. Mm-hmm. His family tells me he ate a lot. He was always, you know, going into the kitchen and eating. And then they started realizing he was starting to lose weight.
Que ya, no, que no quería estar más preso ahí, que se sentía muy... muy angustiado y que eso es muy feo, amigo.
He was starting to show signs of depression because it seemed like he was not going to leave this detention center in Taylor, Texas. But then the dad actually stopped hearing from him. The last text message he received from his son was on March 15th. Carlos Daniel texts his dad.
Ya me envía el sábado a las 7:34. Bendición, papá.
Around 7:30 in the morning, they're taking us away.
Ya nos están sacando.
We're leaving the detention center.
Con el favor de Dios, hoy sí nos vamos.
Praying to God, this will work out.
Yo le coloco que Dios te bendiga, hijo, con la bendición de Dios.
And the dad says, God bless you. With God's blessing, everything will be okay. And that was the last conversation the two had.
A las 7:34 me envió el ese del sábado.
And it's complicated because when I was talking to Juan Terán, he had seen the news that there was a few flights that landed in El Salvador carrying Venezuelan migrants. And he was telling me that he had this feeling, this gut feeling that his son was there. But the hard part, Gene, is that the U.S. government has not provided a list of the men they sent to El Salvador. They have refused to do so over and over. They say this is part of a counterterrorism operation and that they cannot provide that information. So parents like Juan Terán and others are just left to try to guess. They're looking at videos put out by the government of El Salvador. And that was one of the ways that parents were able to identify their kids, was by watching these videos to try to see if they can find their sons in that prison or in those like little 30, 40 second videos. And they're just left with like guessing, trying to like figure out where their sons are. And that is one of the hardest things, according to Juan Terán.
No, de verdad, triste, triste. Yo he estado trabajando mal porque...
Juan is the dad. He tells me that it's not knowing where his son is what's driving him crazy. He's not able to sleep at night. I mean, when I visited Juan the other day, I showed up to his house. The first thing he did was show me a photo that Carlos's mom had sent him.
La mamá me acaba de pasar una foto, no sé quién le pasaría esta foto. Pero bueno, tiene mucho parecido.
And it was a photo portraying a group of men, some of them with their heads without hair, others they still had their hair on, and the mom was saying that one of the men in that photo was her 18-year-old son.
Sí, bien parecido.
And Juan sits with me. He's zooming in, zooming out, zooming in, zooming out. Just like trying to see if that's his son. Of course, it's not the best quality of photos, so it's kind of hard to identify him. So then Juan is left to guessing, right? He starts telling me.
Me dice, me parece que es hijo mío. Él es orejón, ve, que tiene la oreja. A mí se me parece que sí es.
Well, this man looks like him. Like, he has big ears, and my son has big ears, and he's skinny. So, I mean, big ears and he's skinny. He really looks like him. I think it's him.
Está en shock. Pero sí, sí, eh.
But he's not sure.
Right.
Yet this moment was the closest Juan had been to be close to the truth, or like to finding the truth of where his son is.
Mm-hmm.
I do have to mention that our reporting colleagues and friends at CBS News, they were able to get a list of the men sent to El Salvador. Okay. And when I saw those that news, I clicked on it like a lot of people did, and I started going through the list. And this list has over 230 people. And I remember keep scrolling, and I was like, I'm just curious if he's here, you know? And also as I'm scrolling, I'm thinking, you know, would this be better for Juan or not? Like, for him knowing that his son is on this list, or would this kill him? Would this be worse?
Right.
And then I get to the part of last names that starts with the letter T. And there I see it. Terán Aguilar, Carlos. He is on that list.
So we know he's there, but we don't know how he's doing.
Right. Yeah, it's almost like unofficially we know he's there based on this leaked document that CBS News published. But
right,
it hasn't come from the official mechanism, from the White House, from the U.S. government, from the entity that sent this man to El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
Carlos Daniel Jean is 18 years old. And I keep saying this, you know, if you realize in our conversation, I've mentioned his age a few times. And that is because it is our understanding that he's one of the youngest Venezuelans to be picked up and to be sent to El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that Juan Terán, the dad, told me is that he feels like his son is not mentally strong because of his age. So he is terrified of what will happen to him, more than physically, mentally. One of the things he told me is that he wonders who his son will be when he leaves El Salvador.
Yeah, the prison in El Salvador, where Carlos may be, is this prison that was opened in 2023.
Mm-hmm.
It supposedly has the capacity to hold 40,000 people, and it has a notorious reputation mm-hmm. already.
Yeah, I mean, international human rights groups have said that, you know, in that prison, human rights are violated all the time. I mean, first, I just want you to picture this, because I think this is something, Gene, that I keep thinking about, especially about the videos that we saw of the Venezuelan men going into this prison in El Salvador, which is known mm-hmm. as Secot. That prison, you know, the men start showing up, the Venezuelan men, they deplane, they're transported in buses, and they stop there. They get to this prison, to Secot. And we start seeing how guards are like holding them in a very uncomfortable way and then putting them on their knees, and they start shaving their heads. And that's on video.
Yeah, I saw those videos. Very disturbing.
And all these men are meant to look the same, right? They have their heads are shaved. They have these white uniforms. And then they're put up in these cells that can hold up to 70 people each cell. And they don't leave the cell pretty much for 23 plus hours. They don't get to go outside at all. They don't get to talk to a lawyer at all. They don't receive visitors.
Hmm.
In fact, a State Department source told NPR that within that agency, the Trump administration has not shared evidence to back the claims that these men are Tren de Aragua. But also, this source believes these men will never have a trial and will die at Secot. They will die in El Salvador.
I mean, listening to what you're saying, it feels like these people are being kind of like unpersoned.
Mm-hmm. The other hard part, Gene, here is that, you know, these men are being accused, but there hasn't been any conviction. There hasn't been any, you know, day in court. In the case of Carlos Daniel, ICE released a statement saying he was Tren de Aragua.
Hmm. How would they even know that? What would be the signifiers?
We don't know. I mean, I've been asking ICE and the Department of Homeland Security over and over, at this point for over a month, to provide information that, you know, can show that he is Tren de Aragua. But the government has not provided any information to back that up.
Hmm. I mean, it reminds me of the way that sort of anti-gang
mm-hmm.
policing happens in the United States, where it's like a lot of it is just vibes. Like, it's like, okay, this person dresses this way and lives in this neighborhood. Therefore, they are affiliated with Gang X, right? It's like, it's a lot less scientific and empirical than you would think. A lot of it is incredibly subjective.
Right.
And what we see when that happens domestically is that a whole bunch of people just sort of get swept up in those sort of gang sweeps because they're the right age and the right ethnicity, and they live in the right or wrong neighborhoods, I guess.
Yeah, and in this case, tattoos seem to play a big role, you know, in these cases, although according to his dad, Carlos Daniel did not have any tattoos when he was arrested.
Which is what the government is saying is like a big signifier. Right,
right? And I can't stop thinking about this presentation slide that was put out by the Texas Department of Public Safety. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty much saying, this is some of the things we use to identify people, to identify people who are members of Tren de Aragua. And they talk about certain tattoos. They say people have roses. They say people have clocks. They talk about tattoos of felines. And they say that is enough to show that someone might be part of Tren de Aragua.
So roses, clocks, and cats.
Yeah, yeah. And turns out that's not necessarily true. I talked to Rona Rizquez. She is an investigative journalist.
Periodista de investigación venezolana.
From Venezuela, who has written a book about Tren de Aragua.
Autora del libro El Tren de Aragua.
And Jean, I asked her about one of the tattoos that the Texas Department of Public Safety says is part of Tren de Aragua. And it's this phrase called Real Hasta la Muerte. Now, for many people, that might mean nothing. If you're Puerto Rican or you like reggaeton like I do, that that phrase is very familiar because it's a tattoo that a lot of people I know have, and it means real until I die.
O sea, por ejemplo, este Real Hasta la Muerte es un tatuaje que tiene un cantante puertorriqueño, Anuel.
AA, tú sabes que la calle tiene nombre y apellido, y es Real Hasta la Muerte.
Y que muchos jóvenes se lo han copiado reproduciendo, digamos que su fanatismo por este cantante.
She says it comes from a Puerto Rican singer named Anuel AA, which, by the way, my mom does not like him. I think I have to say that here. But you know, she's saying that it comes from this reggaeton singer from Puerto Rico, who is not from Venezuela, who is not Tren de Aragua. It's just a phrase he coined. And she says that a lot of young people, and this is something we know, get tattoos out of, you know, because it's trendy, because it's cool. And this is one of those moments. She says she doesn't doubt that some Tren de Aragua might have Real Hasta la Muerte tattooed on their bodies, but it's not necessarily a thing used by the organization to identify if they are members or not.
Los tatuajes no son un signo de identificación del Tren de Aragua. Puede ser que haya algún miembro del Tren de Aragua que tenga un tatuaje, pero eso no es suficiente como para identificarlo como miembro del Tren de Aragua. Se requiere de una investigación un poco más profunda.
You know, when you're talking about this, I can't help but think about, to go back to like the way that we deal with like gangs in the United States, a lot of times like this is a thing that identifies someone as being from this gang. And then they will like grab somebody who does not have that identifier, right? They don't have the tattoo or the clothing or whatever it is. And then the response from the police is often, well, obviously everyone's not going to wear a tattoo or have this clothing on because that would identify them as part of the gang. There's basically like everything is probable cause here.
And, you know, there's this lawsuit that the ACLU and others have filed against the Trump administration over the men that they sent to El Salvador. And at the core of it is a lack of due process, which is their ability to challenge their accusations and, you know, that they are treated fair under the law. The ACLU say the men sent overseas were not afforded that. They say many don't have criminal records. And that's something even the administration has conceded. And yet that lack of criminal record is enough for them to be arrested.
Okay, wait. So they're saying the lack of evidence against these men is itself evidence that these guys were up to no good.
Yeah, basically. I mean, the Trump administration say that lack of record and information highlights the risk these men pose.
Coming up, we hear from parents banding together to look for loved ones swept up by ICE and who could now be in any of several different countries. Stay with us. Gene.
Sergio.
Code Switch. So, Sergio, you've been telling us about Carlos Daniel and his family's search for him after he was picked up by ICE in Texas. But there were hundreds of other people on those flights to El Salvador. So what do we know about them and their families?
I mean, all of these people that were sent to El Salvador are men. And most of them are pretty young, right? And, you know, their parents are desperate.
Estoy horrorizada. Yo siento que mi hijo está en un abismo y eso es lo que me tiene preocupada.
No tengo palabras para explicarle a su hija que dónde está su papá si su papá le dijo que ya venía. No te imaginas lo que duele eso.
And something interesting has happened throughout this time, and that is that the parents have started to connect with each other on different groups on WhatsApp. And, you know, it's become like this virtual Plaza de Mayo. That is, you know, the plaza during the dictatorship of Videla in Argentina in the 1970s, you know, the plaza where the moms connect with each other and to protest the disappearances of their sons during that dictatorship. And, you know, these are all women who were looking for their families who had disappeared. And I think that a lot of us never thought that this could happen here in this country, but here we are.
Mucha gente, esto es mentira, eso es política, no, esto es verdad. Y hoy es mi hijo, mañana puede ser el hijo de otra madre.
Entonces, ¿me da su nombre y su apellido?
Mi nombre es Mercedes Llamarte.
Mirelis Cacique López.
Mi apellido Sequera.
¿Y usted la mamá de?
Joyker David Sequera.
De Francisco Javier García Cacique.
Mervin José Llamarte Fernández.
Se llama My Friend Amado Durán Arapé.
This group has a mix of relatives whose loved ones were sent to Secot, but also to Guantánamo. You see, even before the news of Venezuelan immigrants being sent to El Salvador, there was an initial roundup of folks who were sent to Guantánamo who were also accused of being a part of Tren de Aragua. And so they're all connecting over this shared experience and sharing information.
Todo el mundo dice, Mercedes, ¿por qué no te pintas el pelo? Mercedes, ¿por qué no salí? Cuando una madre tiene su hijo por fuera, se acabó la vida.
This mom is saying how everybody is asking her why she's not leaving her house, why she's so depressed. And they're on WhatsApp every day. They're asking if they've heard anything about their sons or loved ones. They're sharing news articles from the US, from Venezuelan media, lots of TikTok videos, and they're also providing each other emotional support. I mean, they're fighting together. They're doing joint interviews. They're helping each other connect with attorneys in the U.S. and groups like the ACLU.
Los que tienen ahorita no son delincuentes y no tienen por qué dañarle la vida a un muchacho sano.
All of them say the same thing. Their loved ones are innocent and they are being mistreated by the U.S. government and now the government of El Salvador.
¿Dónde están las pruebas? ¿A qué lo están vinculando realmente? ¿Cuáles son los crímenes? ¿Qué es lo que ellos alegan? Y si eres acusado de algo, tienen que respetarte tu proceso.
Due process. That's what the relatives keep saying. They want their loved ones to have due process, even if that means their loved ones will be back in Venezuela. And when you think about it, Jean, it's kind of crazy because for the longest time, these mothers did not want their sons to be in Venezuela. For over a decade, the country's economy has been unstable and the regime of President Nicolás Maduro has gone after and at times jailed those who have opposed him. One of the moms I talked to is Mirelis Cacique. Her son was already set for deportation. He had signed his own deportation, his voluntary departure, because he was ready to go back home. And that's what he believed when he last talked to his mom. He told his mom, "Mom, we're being moved. I think I'm going back to Venezuela."
Y yo le digo, tranquilo, hijo, no te preocupes. Que tú vienes para tu país.
And the last thing his mom told him was,
yo no te preocupes por mí, que yo voy a ver los aviones y yo voy a saber que tú vas a venir.
You're coming home. I'll watch the flights, I'll watch the airplanes in the sky, and I know you'll be on one of them.
Dios te bendiga. Esas fueron mis palabras hasta el final.
And that never happened.
Oh, man.
He ended up landing in El Salvador, and she learned about it because she was able to identify her son because of the tattoos.
Lo reconocieron, porque mi hijo tiene unos tatuajes de colores en el brazo, un solo brazo tatuado, y ahí se le veían los colores y se distinguía. Y nosotros lo conocemos por su contextura, sus orejas, su cabeza.
So Trump spent his campaign promising, you know, mass deportations, and he spent a lot of time dehumanizing immigrants. It seems like I don't know, it seems like there's been a priming of people to not react, right? To see these men as, you know, less than human, as, you know, as people who deserve this treatment because they're so dangerous.
Yeah, and I think, you know, quite frankly, I think that these actions that he's taking now, 10, 15, 20 years ago, would have been a no from the get-go. They would have received so much backlash from not only Democrats, the de facto opposition party here, but also from like members of the Republican Party and other groups.
And then CBP1, this app the Biden administration created that Carlos's family used to come to this country, has now been changed into a self-deportation app?
Yes. The Trump administration added a feature for people using the app to report themselves as having entered illegally and say they'll leave voluntarily, with the hope that doing so could give them a path to enter the U.S. legally. I think we have to consider and talk a little bit more about fear and how it's playing such a big role here, right? The Trump administration is saying, if you are in this country without legal status, you must go home. You must self-deport. And I think that is playing, you know, that's getting into the heads of some of the migrants who are saying, actually, I don't want my family separated, so I might consider doing that. The thing is that they have expressed also this fear that even if they say they will self-deport, nothing guarantees them that they're actually going to go back to their home countries. And so migrants are left in this limbo. It's like, okay, I came through a legal pathway. Now the legal pathway has been taken away. Now I will become undocumented. I will not have legal status. And if I say yes to self-deport, I might end up in El Salvador. If I say no to self-deport, I might get picked up and end up in El Salvador or somewhere else. And I think Trump's actions are also influencing how immigrants see their stay in the U.S. or even this idea of the, you know, American dream. I know definitely migrants are thinking about this more and more. One of the interviews that I did, Gene, someone mentioned to me that people in Venezuela are watching what's happening in the U.S. with terror and fear because they feel that they know this story way too well.
No sabemos qué puede pasar aquí. A nosotros nos da miedo que nos deporten, nos separen y no sepamos nada.
Marian, Carlos' stepmother, is talking also about, again, this fear and about how she feels in this limbo. She was telling me that if the law is going to remove all Venezuelans, then there's no escape. They can come into their house because they know where this family lives.
Podemos estar durmiendo, podemos estar en cualquier momento y van a llegar.
I asked them if going back to Venezuela was a possibility, like if they have thought about this after what happened to Carlos Daniel.
Sí, ya nuestro pensado era irnos todos juntos. No me cabe duda alguna de que me quiero regresar pa mi país.
And he said this thing that
igual también seguimos temiendo por la integridad de
super important and that I have thought about over and over, which is that
el día de mañana puede ser de mí que me agarren en la calle.
Yes, they all want to live together.
O igualmente vengan acá a la casa a buscarnos.
Because he's worried that he will be taken next.
Sé que la cosa está fuerte, está dura. Sé que no es fácil.
And he had told me that he supported the opposition in Venezuela. He does not support the government of Nicolás Maduro.
Sé que ahí sigue estando el dictador Maduro. Y
but at this point, he tells me,
es lamentable lo que voy a decir, pero ya como que toca decir como dice el dicho.
If you can't beat them, join them.
Si no puedes con el enemigo, únete.
Suggesting that if he were to go back to Venezuela,
ya va a tener que uno adaptarse a la,
he will put his head down,
al sistema de ellos.
Support the regime as long as his family is together.
Nocerio, listening to your story, it seems like the rhetoric that we have in the United States around immigration is that safety is a scarce resource, that only so many people can be secure and protected.
Right.
And that if you're on the wrong side of this line, then this finite resource can't be extended to you.
Yeah, and I think the question is to what is the wrong side, right? Because this administration has been talking over and over about how they want immigrants to come to the U.S. the legal way or do things the right way. And in the case of the Terán family, they came in using a legal pathway. And yet their son has been sent to this maximum security prison in El Salvador. And I think there are two things here. One is the question about due process, which affects us all of us. I mean, in this country, we all want to be treated fair under the law and be granted the opportunity to challenge when we are being accused of anything. And these men sent to El Salvador under the Alien Enemies Act, you know, might not have been given that opportunity. But then also, there's this issue of the Trump administration is telling people, come here the legal way. And yet, they're going after those who are here legally. They're going after people who have green cards, who are permanent residents, who have been allowed into the country through legal pathways. So I think the question is, where does this end? When is someone safe? They followed all the rules. They got a green card, and yet they might be subject to deportation. Or they followed all the rules. They got a student visa, and yet they might be subject to detention and deportation. And I think that is concerning because it makes it very unclear to understand what is right from wrong. Like, what is the right thing to do, or what's the legal way to do things in this country, because Trump has changed that.
And that is our show. You can follow Code Switch on Instagram at NPR Code Switch, all one word. If email, if that's more your jam, ours is codeswitch@npr.org. And please subscribe to the podcast on the NPR app or, you know, wherever it is you get your podcast. You can also subscribe to the Code Switch newsletter by going to npr.org/codeswitchnewsletter. And just a little reminder, not a little one, but signing up for Code Switch Plus is a great way to support our show, to support public media, and you get to listen to every episode sponsor-free. So please go find out more at plus.npr.org/codeswitch. This episode was produced by Christina Kahla. It was edited by Courtney Stein and Dahlia Mortada with help from Luis Treyes. Our engineer was Jimmy Keeley. And we would be remiss if we did not shout out the rest of the Code Switch massive. That's Xavier Lopez, Jess Kung, Leah Donella, Vera Lynn Williams, and B.A. Parker. As for me, I'm Gene Demby. Be easy, y'all.